From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. We will get you updated on the news that made headlines this last week and today. Our panel includes Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, Gretchen Parsons, managing editor with Boise Dev, and Nicole Blanchard, outdoors reporter for the Idaho Statesman. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. I know. Friday before Thanksgiving, if you can believe it. How crazy is that? Melissa, I want to start off today with the head of the Idaho Senate punishing three members of the Idaho Freedom Caucus for criticizing their colleagues. I believe he told the Idaho Statesman that these are the consequences of attacking other people. So what's going on here?
I would say this is the latest flare-up in long simmering tensions within the Idaho Republican Party. These tensions are nothing new. The difference here is the Senate President Pro Tem Chuck Winder is taking action in the halls of the Senate. Senator Glenita Seiderfeld, Senator Brian Lenny, and Senator Scott Herndon were all either reprimanded, and in two cases, two of them were stripped of their committee vice chairmanships for publicly criticizing their colleagues, their Republican colleagues, in emails to their constituents, on social media. These were not official legislative communications, but they were very public and they were repeated. They were criticisms over how their colleagues voted on budget bills and policy measures. Again, these criticisms from some members of the Republican Party targeted at their colleagues, this is nothing new. You know, this has been going on. These tensions have been going on for decades. I think the difference is the manner in which these criticisms are becoming public, you know, with the proliferation of social media, with the ability of lawmakers to email constituents directly, to blog, to post on Facebook. I think that raises the temperature a little bit. And the fact that Chuck Winder is taking the step to, instead of just reprimand people, actually remove them from vice chairmanships of committees is pretty remarkable. Both Senator Lenny and Senator Seiderfeld said that they hadn't heard from Chuck Winder before this, no sort of warning or anything like that, saying, hey, maybe you should knock this off, this isn't appropriate. It just went straight via letter to removing them from their chairmanships. I think this is absolutely a precursor to what will be a heated 2024 primary. That's something that all of us are kind of gearing up for. And I think this, like I said, it's just the latest flare up. This isn't, you can't look at this in a silo. It is the latest in a long running series of tensions between these two factions within the party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it will definitely be an interesting session, I think. Kevin, let me bring you into the conversation because the state of Tennessee is considering refusing federal funds for schools so they don't have to follow the rules that come with getting that cash. So can you tell us about this? Because this is something Idaho has considered doing on and off for a couple of decades now, correct?
Yeah, I mean, speaking of something that's age old, I mean, this has been something that legislators and folks in conservative circles have talked about for a long time. They've kind of bristled at the amount of red tape that comes with federal funding for education. Lately, that's taken on you know, new dimension with concerns about federal dictates or federal directives on things like transgender accommodations in schools. So what Tennessee is doing, and the reason I wrote about it, is they've put together a legislative committee that is actively studying the pros and cons of pulling out of federal funding, opting out of federal funding entirely. In their case, it's like $1.8 billion. In Idaho's case, it's a pretty considerable amount of money. When you factor out all of the COVID-19 aid that has come to the schools, which is one-time money, which is going to come off of the books at some point here in the next couple of years, you're still talking about well over $200 million, actually probably closer to $300 million. And this money generally goes to support kids who are most in need. It goes into special education. It goes into child nutrition programs. It goes into various title programs that are designed to help English language learners, at-risk learners. So it's really, it's money that helps the students who are in most need in Idaho schools. And as I talked to State Superintendent Debbie Critchfield at some length about this week, and I'll be really curious to see if anything comes of this, any further discussion comes of this session. Critchfield has mixed feelings about it, but she's studying it within the halls of the State Department of Education. They've done some data gathering to try to figure out what this would cost, how much money we're talking about. They've mm-hmm. They've reached no conclusions about whether this is a good idea or not. But again, Melissa talked about it in the opening segment of how what's going on in the Senate. This is an election year. You've got 105 legislators, 105 legislative seats up for grabs. It would not surprise me in the slightest if you heard more talk about this during the Idaho legislative session coming up in January. It's a hot button issue, and it has been for a while.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Nicole, I want to talk with you about a really sad story and one that I potentially could hit Idaho in the pocketbook. And this is the zombie deer disease, and it's spreading to McCall. So tell us first what it is and how it impacts deer, but what will it mean for hunters and sportsmen?
Sure, Gemma. So this was an interesting update. The zombie deer disease is kind of another name for what's called chronic wasting disease. It affects all members of the deer species. So it can affect mule deer, whitetail deer, elk. I believe it can also affect moose, but that hasn't been detected in Idaho. It is a prion disease. So it's these malformed proteins that build up in the brain and they cause neurological issues. So a lot of animals that have this are very malnourished. They are exhibiting some neurological symptoms like trouble walking. They appear like kind of confused, and they don't seem to have like a normal or appropriate level of fear around humans, like just kind of odd behavior. It's in kind of the same vein as like mad cow disease. Okay. So this was first found in Idaho just about 2 years ago, but it was near Riggins. It was really isolated, and that's the only place that had been found until recently. A hunter had I believe a mule deer this year near McCall, and that deer tested positive for chronic wasting disease. So this is the first time that we're seeing it moving around in Idaho, which I think is the most concerning part for fish and game officials.
So where do they go from here with this, Nicole?
So it's interesting. They talked about how managing this area for chronic wasting disease is going to be a bit different than how they've addressed it up near Riggins. I guess the area that this deer was harvested in, a lot of the animals have already moved out of that area for winter weather. And so what worked in Riggins, which was doing a big kind of cull hunt to get a feel for how widespread this was and to kind of try to reduce numbers and reduce spread of the disease, that's not necessarily going to work here. So it remains to be seen how exactly Fish and Game intends to kind of prevent this. But I should have mentioned earlier that there's no cure for this. So it's not like they can go out and give some kind of medication or treat this in some way. This is a disease that's been in other parts of the country for a couple decades now and has been pretty devastating in some other states in the Midwest. And there's not really much of a solution for it at this point.
Okay. Gretchen, Boise's Urban Renewal Agency wants to build a new park in downtown Boise, but some controversy surrounding this. Because it won't have any real grass. So what's going on here?
Yeah, so commissioners weren't thrilled about that. The plan for now is to put turf in there. And they said that was because that's what Boise Parks and Rec prefers. But I mean, if you've ever been in turf, it heats up really quickly. It's personally not my favorite. But So that would be one element. And then other things, they want to have a stage area so bands could perform there or different like performances, that type of thing. There would also be shade canopies, a community table, some sort of public art element. The city of Boise, they were trying to get an artist for this and that kind of fell through. So they're going to try again so they can incorporate a public art piece. This is still kind of a ways off though, because if everything is approved, it probably wouldn't open till around summer 2025. So it's a little, little out there. Yeah.
Okay. So at this point, where is it in the stage of planning then and this actually coming to fruition?
So that, let me pull that up, standby. So it should go in for approval or not with Boise City Council soon. I don't know that there's an exact date yet, but that would be okay. The next step that City Council would have to sign off on it.
Okay, appreciate that. So I think we're going to spend this next segment talking quite a bit about the University of Idaho. So Kevin, there is a whole lot of news on this ongoing saga with the U of I's proposed purchase of the University of Phoenix, including the fact that a trial over the deal is going to go ahead. So why don't you give us some updates? I know, Melissa, you've been looking at this too, so chime in as well. But Kevin, can we first start maybe with people who have not been paying much attention about this potential acquisition of the University of Phoenix and how it came about?
Yeah, so University of Phoenix 101 here. The University of Idaho wants to acquire the University of Phoenix, which is a giant for-profit online university, serves about 85,000 students. That would involve about $685 million of financing and bonding that would be done through a nonprofit that is very closely affiliated with the U of I. I mean, you know, administrators from the U of I would serve on the board of this nonprofit. So this purchase has been in the works now for several months. U of I and Phoenix hope to get it done by early next year. There are a lot of factors that stand in the way of getting this done by the early part of 2024. And one of the big ones right now is the lawsuit. Attorney General Raul Labrador has sued the State Board of Education, which approved this deal. Saying that their closed-door meetings back in the spring to discuss the purchase were in violation of open meetings law. That has been going back and forth now for months. I wrote about a couple of developments on this earlier this week. A district judge in Boise has said that this will go to trial, as you mentioned. So there will be a trial in January, and it's going to focus on one aspect of Labrador's lawsuit. It focuses on, was there competition? Did the U of I have other bidders that they were competing against in their pursuit of the University of Phoenix? That's been really kind of sketchy. That's been hard to kind of pin down. We don't know many specifics about competitors other than the University of Arkansas, which kind of pulled out of the process in April before the U of I went forward with a proposed purchase of Phoenix. So we'll have a trial in January. It starts on January 22nd to hash that out. It's gotten to the point now, and I wrote about this on Thursday, the two sides aren't just arguing about open meetings law. They're arguing about who ought to pay the lawyers. The Attorney General's office sent a letter back to the State Board this week saying, well, we're actually not going to pay your outside legal counsel costs, which are at least $81,000 that we know of at this point. It's going to be higher, no question about that. They're saying that the State Board didn't go through the proper process to hire an outside attorney. They really needed to go through the governor. That didn't happen. Because they went outside and hired their own attorney, they're paying the lead attorney $300 an hour. AG's office says, well, if we'd just done this in-house and appointed a deputy AG to the case, that'd be $185 an hour billable. So there's arguing about, how much is this costing and who should pay the bills. Amidst all of this, Gemma, there is one development that I think is also pretty significant that we learned about this week. The accreditors for Phoenix have signed off on this purchase. Basically, Phoenix had to go back to the accreditors and say, look, are you okay with us operating under this umbrella of the University of Idaho? Will that jeopardize our accreditation? It won't. So the accreditors for Phoenix have given the deal their blessing. The accreditors for University of Idaho need to do the same thing. It's not clear when they're exactly going to take that question up. So, you know, welcome to my world, Gemma. This is what I've been writing about, it seems like, on the daily for the last 6 months. We're a long way from this thing being resolved.
Okay, so Kevin, can I just go back to the lawsuit for a minute?
Sure.
Oh, so why does it matter if there was competition or not? I'm just a bit confused as to why that would matter and why that would need to go to trial.
It comes down to the reason why the state board held the closed meetings in the first place. And the state board used a clause in state law that says we can have closed discussions if a state agency is considering a purchase that puts them in competition, and this is the important part, in competition with another state, another public, a public entity in another state or nation. So it has to be another state university, for example, or an international buyer that's a public sector international buyer. It can't be a private firm that wants to purchase Phoenix. That's a very important piece of the language of the law. And that's where we are on this lawsuit.
Can I jump in real quick?
Please.
Yes.
Please.
Just to build on what Kevin has explained really well. Open meeting law in Idaho, it sounds like a wonky thing, but it's so important because the public's business in Idaho is presumed to be public unless a board or commission can cite a very specific exemption. Those exemptions are laid out in Idaho law. Kevin just explained the exemption that the state board tried to use here. There hasn't been any public evidence, Labrador is arguing, that that exemption holds up. And again, it sounds wonky, but if the judge ends up siding with Labrador, it could jeopardize the entire acquisition. And right, that's what it comes down to. Usually, and we see this with everything from county commissions and very small boards to state agencies, if there is an alleged open meeting violation, usually the cure is to just go back and redo it the right way. The state board chose not to do this. This is rare. They doubled down and said, we believe that we were in the right here. And Kevin and I have talked about this on Idaho Reports. That's often remarkable because usually a commission will say, oh, sorry, let's make sure we do this the right way. That's not what happened here.
Right. And Melissa gets to the heart of it. I mean, this is not just a dispute over open meetings, which I'll get excited about. Melissa will get excited about. We'll all get excited about in the media and should. I mean, government should operate in the open. But it goes much deeper than that. I mean, well, like Melissa says, if Labrador prevails in court, the whole purchase is thrown into jeopardy. You know, it voids the whole decision that the state board made back in May, takes them back to the drawing board. Who knows what happens to this purchase if that happens? So this is a very important lawsuit.
So it's not necessarily, I mean, yes, if there was competition, that's, or other, I guess, other bidders, that's why the State Board of Education is saying, well, we could hold these private meetings. However, the argument against that is, well, you'd violated open meeting laws. Am I understanding this correctly?
Right. The open meeting law is pretty clear in this case. You have to establish that you're discussing preliminary negotiations of a deal in which you're in competition with a public entity in another state or another nation. So it has to be a public entity. It can't be a private entity. And beyond the University of Arkansas, which we've talked about already, I have never seen any specifics about, you know, a bidder in another state, by name. Mm-hmm. You know, you have, you know, 49 other states to choose from here. I've never heard another state mentioned specifically. And, you know, this is something that's been, you know, talked about a lot in depositions between the AG's office and state board members. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out in trial.
Yeah. Well, and when this news was revealed about this purchase, Kevin, I think it took everybody by surprise because it had been, you know, in private.
Yeah, it went from nobody knew much of anything about what was going on here until the day before the state board actually approved it. We get a news release and, you know, people's jaws drop. And, you know, it went public very quickly and obviously became controversial very quickly. You know, what we're now starting to get a sense of, either through the trials and through the deposition, is kind of a sense of what exactly was discussed behind closed doors. Mm. I was able to read those depositions a couple of weeks ago, wrote about them in some depth. There's, yeah, it answers some questions about how we got there. It raises more questions about how we got there.
Right. Well, and then as you mentioned, they're now fighting over lawyers' fees. And Kevin, part of it is, if I'm understanding this correctly, is that the Attorney General's office is refusing to pay the bill for the State Board of Ed's lawyers because they hired outside counsel. But normally in a situation like this, wouldn't the Attorney General's office be the lawyer for, you know, a state agency or entity like the school board, like the state board?
Right, which is exactly why the state board said they needed to hire outside counsel, because you're right, the Attorney General's office provides legal counsel to every state agency in Idaho, including the State Board of Education. You know, the state board has its own deputy attorney general assigned to that office. But, you know, she said right away, look, I can't defend the state board against, you know, my boss, the attorney general, and his staff in a lawsuit. You've got to bring in an outside attorney. So that's why an outside attorney was brought in the first place. Now the question is about the process and the cost. It's just a further sign of how bitter this fight is becoming between the Attorney General's office and the state board, which is made up largely of Brad Little appointees.
Mm-hmm. So at this point, we are now waiting for this trial to move forward in January, and that could potentially, possibly decide the fate of the University of Idaho, depending upon how this trial goes.
And it somewhat slows down the process because, you know, something to keep in mind is that when Phoenix and the U of I reached this agreement to pursue a purchase, there is a May 31st date coming up next year that would be kind of an opt-out date for either side. You know, they could look at where things are, where the process lies, you know, how much progress has been made towards a purchase. And either side at that point could say, yeah, we got to walk away. We got to do something else. Now, I'm not saying that's going to happen, but I'm saying that could happen and that could loom if this lawsuit continues to linger, if it's appealed to the state Supreme Court and the state Supreme Court were to take it up, you know, any number of things. Plus, you know, the nonprofit that the U of I has set up to run this, to engineer this purchase, they've got to go out to market. They've got to find they got to go into the bond market and position themselves to sell, you know, $685 million worth of bonds. That's no small undertaking.
Yeah, to say the least. I appreciate the update on that. I mean, it is convoluted and it is layered for sure. So, Nicole, there's a controversy brewing between the state's Wolf Control Board and a couple of ranches over a plan to trap wolves and then shoot them from a helicopter. This story is pretty convoluted. So can you break it down for us?
Sure, Gemma. So the Wolf Depredation Control Board is a board in the state that basically allocates money to control, lethally control, kill wolves over livestock depredation. That's where the depredation part comes in. When wolves are killing livestock, this is supposed to be the remedy to that through killing wolves. So a couple years ago, the legislature passed a bill that allowed the Wolf Control Board to work with private contractors. So prior to this year, the Wolf Control Board has only allocated funds to government agencies, mostly wildlife services. So they have kind of decided to dip their toes into this private contractor thing. And there's a little bit of confusion where it comes to the contractors. So the Depredation Control Board is not entering into contracts with like companies that kill wolves, that advertise themselves as like predator control. They're not entering into these contracts with trappers. The way that they decided to do this was to work with what they're calling agriculture producers, so ranchers, people who own the livestock that are concerned about wolves killing their sheep and their cattle. And they launched this over the summer and got a couple applications, I think five of them this year. And so late last month, they went through the applications that they had received from agriculture producers. They looked at the scope of what the producers were proposing, which included some on-the-ground trapping and some aerial gunning, which is the shooting from a helicopter that you mentioned. And they said, okay, these project proposals sound good. We'll move ahead to the part where we start putting together the legal contracts with these people, with these ranchers. But some wolf advocates, so folks who are with the International Wildlife Coexistence Fund, the Wood River Wolf Project over in the Sun Valley area, were like, well, wait a second, one of these applications supposedly came from some ranches that we work with in the Wood River Wolf Project, which is non-lethal deterrence. And they say that they've had a lot of success in preventing wolves from hunting sheep without killing the wolves. So their director, Suzanne Stone, reached out to the ranches, Flat Top Ranch over in the Haley area and Faulkner Land and Livestock in the same area. And they said, no, we don't know what this application is about. So that's where the kind of tension is. This was supposed to be a $50,000 proposal. Obviously, no money has changed hands yet. It was in very preliminary stages. But as far as anyone can tell, the proposal actually came from a predator control corporation owner named Trevor Walsh. And that's kind of the real concerning thing here, is that he was able to submit an application and that it started to move ahead without anyone realizing that the ranches were not involved in any way and hadn't signed on to this. And they are the ones who were supposed to be the contractors.
Okay. All right. Well, I really appreciate that update. And when I said it was layered, you proved that right.
Yeah, so, it's complicated for sure.
Yeah, appreciate that. So Melissa, this week, the governor announced that the head of health and welfare, Dave Jeppesen, is retiring at the end of this year. And the governor said that he actually stayed longer than had originally been the plan. So does this have anything to do with the controversy over the audit of health and welfare, over spending federal funds on children? Because the department has been at odds with a lot of members of the Idaho legislature, and that could come to a head, I'm assuming, in the new session come January. So does his stepping down now have anything to do with that as well?
From the public statements from health and welfare and from the governor's office, no. This was a planned retirement that Director Jeppesen actually seemingly put off a little bit. He said that he originally intended to serve for 2 to 4 years, shepherding Idaho at the time through Medicaid expansion. Then COVID-19 hit. That's something that he helmed the Department of Health and Welfare through as well. So according to this press release from the governor's office, he actually stayed longer than he had originally intended to. If you think back to other health and welfare directors, the agency is never without controversy, right? This is the largest state agency. They're dealing with billions of dollars, both state and federal. So is there ever a good time to retire? You could point to potential reasons for any of these retirements. Mm-hmm. So what we know is that he is serving until the end of December. Department of Insurance Director Dean Cameron is going to step in as interim director of health and welfare. Director Cameron long-serving lawmaker representing the Minnetonka area and serving as the longtime co-chair of the Joint Budget Committee. So he's familiar with the legislature. He's familiar with state agencies and how budgets work, even if he isn't, you know, an expert in Medicaid necessarily or these different mm-hmm. divisions. He's familiar with the budget process and he's familiar with the legislature. Meanwhile, Governor Little is going to be looking for a replacement for Director Jepson. So all of that, circling back around to your question, I think anyone could read what they want to in the timing of this retirement, but he could have retired when COVID was, when he was facing right. all of the criticisms from COVID. He could have retired at the start of these investigations into the child care grants. I don't know that there was any time that he could have retired that people wouldn't question why. Mm.
So, Melissa, as you mentioned, then Dean Cameron will be taking over as the interim director while the search is on for a permanent replacement. I'm assuming then that he will need to face lawmakers when the session starts. But, you know, in an interim position, that might be a little bit more difficult than someone who has been there for so long and maybe knows more of the history.
Again, I don't know that there was any good, like any perfect person to fill that position, right? This is an incredibly complex budget. And even with Director Jepson and before him, Director Dick Armstrong, you saw them relying heavily on their division heads, right? When they mm-hmm. get questions from lawmakers about specific things like child welfare or Medicaid welfare, they would call on those division heads anyway to better explain the intricacies of those budgets and how the department is spending that money. I guess the benefit of having Dean Cameron in this position is that there is nobody in the state who understands the legislature's budget setting process better than the longtime co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee, this very committee that he's presenting to. So if you're already in this tough position of having an interim director, it, you know, during the budget setting process, it might as well be somebody who's familiar with budget setting, if not the exact ins and outs of the Department of Health and Welfare, because you have other division heads within that agency who can step up and help with those details.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, Melissa. There's just never a good time, right, for someone to take a rightful retirement like the director is. So best of luck.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that people would be questioning the timing no matter when he retired. And so,
yeah.
But that's certainly I would say fraught time for health and welfare, but it often is. Like I said, there are often questions surrounding how they're spending, how they're operating their programs. So we'll see how the next session plays out mm-hmm. and we'll see when Governor Little appoints a permanent replacement.
Yeah, there's that too. So Gretchen, Mile High Marina in McCall wants to add almost 100 new boat spots, but a new boardwalk as well. So tell us about this plan.
Yeah, so Mile High Marina in McCall, they're hoping to expand. And right now they have like a very long wait list for boat slips. And so this expansion plan, it would add 90 more. So it would help with that demand. And then it would also add like more than 1,000 feet of boardwalk for the public. That would also include benches, shade, possibly a public art element as well. And the stage this is in right now, planning and zoning in McCall, they signed off on it. It would still need approval from City Council, but McCall planning and zoning, they like the project. They like that, you know, it would add more boardwalk for the public. So they were in favor, and we'll see if this gets approval from City Council.
Okay. So Nicole, if you go missing in Idaho's backcountry, first, who goes looking for you? How long do they look? And I know you wrote this story last month, but I think this is good information as we get into kind of that season of like backcountry skiing and things like that.
Yeah, Gemma. So I did a pretty big story based off of a discovery of a missing hiker over the summer. Jack Thomas had been missing for 7 years, and another backpacker just so happened to find some of his personal effects that then led to his remains being found. So I was really interested in, you know, what happens to the folks who aren't found immediately. So fortunately, when someone goes missing, they're typically found pretty quickly. The Idaho Constitution, or the Idaho Code, designates sheriff's offices to deal with this. So when somebody goes missing, it's up to the county sheriff to organize a search party. Some of them do this through their own agency. Some of them work with nonprofits. Like here in Ada County, folks are probably familiar with Idaho Mountain Search and Rescue, who does a lot of that work. And there's not really a lot of regulation beyond that. So there might be a search that goes on for 2 weeks. There might be a search that goes on for a few days. I heard from people who said that they were told by authorities that their loved one couldn't be found and there was no use searching after 2 days. And then I talked with people who said law enforcement was really helpful and dedicated and searched as long as they possibly could before weather made it impossible, which, to your point about us coming into winter and backcountry recreation when there's snow and storms and things like that, you know, that's definitely a limiting factor. So there are some nationwide experts that would really like to see maybe some more federal funding put into this, maybe some more regulations as far as how this gets handed off to a nonprofit or some other kind of organization when the sheriff's offices no longer have the resources to pursue it. But this is a nationwide problem. So it's just interesting to kind of look at it here in Idaho as we grow and as outdoor recreation becomes even more popular.
Yeah, absolutely. So Kevin, Empowering Parents is back. Can you remind folks what the program is, why it became controversial, but also what's new this time around?
Well, it is back. It's back for a second year. And this is a microgrant program that families can use to cover their out-of-pocket education expenses. And a lot of it's been used to help families buy laptops or upgrade their internet. The first year of the program was pretty rocky. There were problems. There were purchases that were covered through taxpayers that should not have been covered, things like smartwatches and TV sets and cameras that were not within the parameters of what the program was supposed to cover. The vendor paid back about $180,000 to the state over that. There is still an audit in progress. The governor asked for an independent audit of the program. Nevertheless, there's $30 million of new money to put into this grant program that was approved by the legislature this spring. And parents can start to apply. The application window opened on Thursday. I'm not sure what kind of application traffic they've seen so far. There are some changes, and there are some new ways that parents can spend the money. It's been expanded to cover things that wouldn't have been covered in the past. Like, well, if you can buy a computer for your kid, now you can buy the computer case or a backpack so they can carry their computer to school. You can cover things like athletic uniforms, or if your school has pay-to-play fees for athletics, you can use grant money for that. It's targeted more towards lower-income households, and there are caps on how much parents can get. It's like $1,000 per kid or $3,000 per household. So applications opened. It's, if based on what we saw last year, it'll probably be a pretty hot commodity. They had plenty of applicants last time around. So now there are new ways to pay for it. If you've looked at this program in the past, if you're listening to this, you might want to check out not just the application window, but check out what is now an eligible purchase, because a lot of that has changed.
And so, Kevin, how long is the window open? I know you said it opened yesterday.
That's a good question. I don't really know. It is right now. I think the first window is for households with an household income of $60,000 or less. A few weeks down the road, then it'll open up to households with $75,000 or less in household income. And then if there's money left over, it's open to everybody.
Okay. Melissa, I know you're in the middle of getting ready for your own show that airs tonight, Idaho Reports. And this week, I know you're looking at the housing shortage, but you'll also have an interview with College of Western Idaho president Gordon Jones. And he's got a proposal to add a four-year degree. So why does he want to expand the community college with a four-year option?
This is a story that Kevin first reported on Idaho Education News last week, actually, and we were able to chat with President Jones about it. He says in our interview, in our conversation, that it's a move that to him made sense, that there was a need in the community for people who have this specific four-year degree in business administration. That they can offer it for a lower cost than other universities while still kind of staying in their lane as far as providing what community colleges traditionally do, which is career-ready technical education and two-year degrees everywhere else. And so they saw, according to President Jones, they saw this need. They were able to make this proposal to fill it. The Board of Trustees approved that or signed off on the proposal, endorsed the proposal last week, and that'll be going before the State Board of Education soon. So it's not a done deal yet. But we talk in this week's episode. It airs 8 p.m. on Idaho Public Television and is available online after it airs at idahoptv.org about how this fits into this broader landscape of higher education in the state of Idaho, and about, you know, whether this is a change in trajectory for the College of Western Idaho, or if this fits in, you know, with their mission already.
Okay. So it has to go, as you said, in front of the board, and then a decision will be made.
Right, exactly. They can't create this new four-year degree program without the state board signing off on it. President Jones pointed out on the show, and I believe Kevin also reported as well, that, you know, this isn't unheard of in community colleges across the nation. Oh. There are, I think, 23 other states where community colleges have the ability to provide four-year degrees. And Idaho allows for that as well. It's just that traditionally community colleges here have offered only the two-year degrees and technical degrees.
Okay. And we can hear that. Go ahead, Kevin.
And it's worth noting too that, you know, in this, it'll be interesting to see how the state board decides about this, because all three of the four-year universities offer business degrees. They just offer it in a different way. This is a different approach to getting to a four-year business administration degree. So it will be interesting to me to see how the state board decides on this.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I want to thank all of you for taking time out of your busy schedules to join us today. I really appreciate all of you, appreciate all of your perspectives. We've been talking with Kevin Richards, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, Gretchen Parsons, managing editor with Boise Dev, and Nicole Blanchard, outdoors reporter for Idaho Statesman. Make sure you follow all of these reporters. We are lucky to have great journalists in our state. Thank you all so much, and I hope you have a great weekend, everybody.
Thanks, Gemma. Have a great weekend.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Did you know you are physically adapting to all your swiping, scrolling, and tapping?
We're changing our bodies and what they're able to do through our habits.
NPR's Body Electric, a special interactive series investigating how to fix the relationship between our tech and our health. Listen in the TED Radio Hour feed wherever you get your podcasts.